I have stopped using misogynist, xenophobe, homophobe, racist, sexist in my columns because I actually found them to be, first of all, I found them to be ineffective. They're just kind of these buzzwords that a lot of people glance over, or they're incendiary to those on the right and just provoke rather than help to start conversations or find common ground or find a common heart.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. I was glad to have the chance to talk civility and politics with Stephen Petro. Stephen is a columnist for the Washington Post and the USA Today, and the author of many books. He's the host of the Civilist podcast, and someone who's thought a great deal about citizenship in our democracy. I heard him give a TED talk in New York City, and I thought he'd be an interesting person to talk to about how to be civil but effective in politics at an uncivil time. He also has a very interesting career in journalism. So, after a quick word from our sponsor, my interview with Stephen Petro.
This episode is brought to you by Graphicacy. Graphicacy is an analytic design firm that can help you advance the mission of your organization using your own real data and information. They are 21st century visual communicators who create interactive graphics, motion graphics, and data visualizations. You can find Graphicacy at graphicacy.com. That is GRAPHICACY.com. With Graphicacy's help, you can visualize a better world.
Would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Sure. This is Stephen Petro, and I write about manners and civility an awful lot. At the same time, I write about health and aging in my spare time. I'm a columnist for the Washington Post and USA Today.
Sounds like a pretty good place to have taken a career. Would you mind talking a little bit about how you moved into the world of journalism in the first place?
When I was growing up and in college, I was determined to do everything different than my dad, who was a journalist.
And nice job.
Yeah, and I've managed to create a life that mirrors his in many, many ways. And so I'm sort of bemused by that. But he had been a television journalist for the local NBC station in New York and then for WNET and Bill Moyers and taught journalism at NYU. And I got the journalism bug myself on the college paper at Duke and kind of went from there.
Tell me a little about the Duke paper.
When I kind of look back, I was a columnist there. And I think my whole life I've really sort of enjoyed having an opinion and arguing my opinion and trying to persuade others. I was the editorial page editor there. That was in the late 1970s and really found journalism an effective tool in the political landscape. And many of the issues in North Carolina then were about race, economic equality, farm worker issues, access to healthcare, the same in so many ways, sadly. That gave me a platform, and I saw that people responded in varying ways. And generally, that was good.
I remember the Senators Helms and Sanford and Governor Hunt, and I'm not sure if I caught quite the right era, but...
You do.
Interesting time in North Carolina, a lot of change.
I grew up in New York City. I went to school in Manhattan, and then I chose of my own free will to come to Duke, which was
quite different.
You know, only 425 miles away, but it might have been, you know, 100 years different at that time and in a very different place. I was looking to go to an environment that would challenge me, and I have to say, I found it. And in many ways, I thought Jesse Helms was just going to hound me for my entire life, though, after that, because when I first came to school here, and I'm back in North Carolina, he was the general manager of the, I believe it was the CBS affiliate. So he was on the TV with his own opinion, quote, columns every day, and they were pretty darn far to the right. And then he became senator, was so vocal about gay issues, and I'm gay, so he just was always front and center in my life and pretty much until the time he passed.
He was definitely the earned boogeyman of the right there for a long time. How did you move into a career out of college and into professional journalism?
I just stayed with Duke for a moment. When I was a student there, I was in a public policy and ethics class, and we were reading a lot about migrant farm worker issues in the South. We read In Praise of Famous Men, or James A.G. Walker Evans' book, Let Us Now Praise Famous Men. We got very activated, and the short story is that we formed a nonprofit called the Duke Migrant Project. That became the basis of a lot of my journalism. And then for the year after I graduated, a friend of mine who was also a photographer and had been on this project, we got a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. And we traveled with farmworker families from Florida to New England for that year. Although I took a little boat trip to Haiti at the very outset, because that was when the Haitian refugees were coming to South Florida. I didn't actually take a boat trip, but I flew over and met many of the families there and then rejoined them in South Florida and then traveled with them. Many of those articles appeared in the St. Petersburg Times. And then, Nathaniel, I sort of can't explain exactly what happened, but I wound up at the Wall Street Journal after that, immediately after that.
A strange fit, yeah. But a real paper.
But a real paper. And I think that, I mean, what was kind of curious about at the time was I was competing against a lot of people. All the others had masters in journalism from Columbia, except for me. And I got that job. And I always thought it must have had something to do with my, you know, on-the-ground experience, but I never actually knew. And I really did not like it at the Journal. I was there, I think, about a year and a half. It's partially the culture. I was also not used to working in an office and being confined that way. And went to graduate school at UC Berkeley in American history, U.S. history, where I had every intention to get my PhD and teach 20th century politics and culture. But things happened.
What sort of things? See how good I am at asking the next question?
I know. I thought, and so good I am, is sort of lobbing it up. Well, about midway through, which was 5 years later, I realized I was at the midpoint and that most people who were ahead of me were taking about 10 years. And most of them, if they were lucky to get jobs, were getting jobs in places where I, as a gay man, would not live. Really small towns in conservative parts of the country. So I really began to sort of question whether this was going to be sort of a viable path for me. Before I managed to finish that conversation in my head, I was diagnosed with testicular cancer. So I was 26 then. And sort of went through basically the year of treatment and then a second year of follow-up when I was deemed to be pretty much in the clear. And then I was diagnosed with HIV/AIDS 2 years later, which turned out to be an incorrect diagnosis. But by the time that was uncorrected, I had sort of gone through this mental exercise where if I have a shortened lifespan, I'm not spending the rest of it at UC Berkeley in U.S. history. So I got to the same place I probably would have started at had I not gotten sort of sick once and fake sick a second time. And part of what came out of that misdiagnosis was the first book that I wrote, which was called Dancing Against the Darkness. And I followed six people and their families pretty much from the time they were diagnosed until, unfortunately, when they all died. I didn't realize at the beginning that would be the end for each of those chapters. And this was really one of the first oral histories, a diverse set of people, an African-American injection drug user in Washington, D.C., a journalist in Hawaii, gay man in San Francisco, and so on. I learned a lot through that, and I guess that was sort of early on where I was taking the skills that I had learned in graduate school, because I had been studying oral history too, and sort of combining with journalism and starting to use my journalism in a very specific political way.
Yeah, that sounds fascinating. What was next for you after that book?
So after that book, I started writing for The Advocate, the LGBT newspaper/magazine, a lot about HIV and a lot about gay rights issues. I did another couple of books, edited them about AIDS prevention in San Francisco, and then a book that was called the HIV Drug Book. This was before the internet, so this was basically an encyclopedia of HIV drugs. I think this was about 1993, 1994. Big, fat, 500-page book that was useless in 2 years, but was very useful at the time because so much was happening. And by that time, I had moved to New York City with a partner. You know, in sort of the back and forth that I seem to have, or that's becoming clear to me now, I started working at Life magazine as a reporter researcher. So I feel like I'm putting together a jigsaw puzzle for myself right now. It's sort of like pieces from the right and pieces from the left, you know, sort of alternating as they come together here, or from the mainstream and non-mainstream. And there I covered science, I covered politics. I mean, one of the pieces I did was on the 25th anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King. I interviewed Harry Belafonte, Lena Horne, a bunch of notables, and I was just mind blown by how much wisdom they had, and especially when Lena Horne called me at home. It was like, it was pretty special. But I believe I digress, Nathaniel, into stormy weather.
Well, these are all things that form us. And what was the route to landing at the Washington Post?
There are a bunch of years in between there, and from Life, I went to Time Inc., skipping over some things. Then that brand new thing at the end of the 1990s, the internet appeared. And so my interest in health galvanized with that new medium. And I was part of a startup that became known as Everyday Health in the early 2000s. I had probably about a 12-year run there as the editorial director, both writing but managing a group of people. And this was sort of the anti-WebMD health site that could be trusted, wasn't influenced by advertisers, had real doctors offering advice. It was 6 or 7 years ago. I had been writing books late at night, sort of always burning at the candle on both sides. And I think at the very end of 2013, I said, okay, I am going to be a full-time writer. I'm going to will it. I have a very good friend in San Francisco who is also a creative, and he had done something similar. He saved this little stockpile that was kind of his startup money. And I did the same thing. So I put X number of dollars in the bank that I was going to draw on either until I went broke or and just keep going at it. And so fortunately, I've been able to keep going at it. I started writing the civilities column, which was called Civil Behavior at the New York Times. And then after about 3 or 4 years, I went to the Post, and there it was civilities, and did it for about 4 years there, and continued to write a different column at the Post now.
What's the source of that fascination with civilities and civil behavior?
Among the books I didn't mention was in 1995, I wrote a book called The Essential Book of Gay Manners and Etiquette. And that was kind of a soft, silly, humorous guide for guys dating and in relationships and so on. It was kind of a relationship advice book. I'd always been interested in this area. It was kind of one of my, I call it one of my fetishes, one of my many PG fetishes, I'll just say. That might be taken the wrong way. I could give you some sort of fluffy answers, but I think the realer answer is, back when I was in North Carolina as an undergraduate, we went to the state legislature to testify, and a number of the professors we were working with talked to us about the importance of persuasion and how you persuade people. And so we always dressed appropriately for a state legislature, which is to say we wore button-down shirts and we wore ties and we were respectful. And then we said what we needed to say, but the package was disarming. And I saw that actually as a very useful strategy. And my own personal mantra has been what is often attributed to the Dalai Lama: know the rules well so that you can break them effectively. So that's kind of the sort of stance I've always taken with civility and with manners. That has really kind of infused a lot of what I write and has helped to provide an underlying political layer to it. I'm really not interested in appropriate behavior, so-called appropriate behavior in air quotes, for that reason, but really as a means to politics or personal means of connection and communication.
At its core, it's really a way of being effective in engaging with the world and helping to change the world rather than out of some kind of aesthetic.
Absolutely. And you heard in my TED talk how I talked about how the word civility itself has sort of undergone this terrible transformation from the original Latin and French, where it really meant being a good citizen, thinking of the larger good, to this idea of decorum and good behavior. I'm often wrestling that back to the original, and I've pretty much abandoned, I've given up on trying to change how Americans and Westerners see the words etiquette and manners, because I just don't think it's possible to divorce them from table settings as much as I've tried. And that how we treat people, how we respect people, how we listen to people is really the basis of good manners rather than sort of all that other superficial stuff.
As you referenced, I had the good fortune to go up to New York and see you give a TED talk quite recently. Somewhat of a strange situation with people beamed in from different places around the world, but also some very good speakers.
Including Eve Perlman, your sister.
Yes.
Let's give her the plug she is due.
And that'll make all the difference. What was the thesis of your talk up there?
The thesis of my talk was really about this definition of civility. And then the title was How Civility Has Become a Dirty Word in This Country. And that is, I made the point that those on the right see it as a form of censorship, the left just wanting to shut down conversations with this notion of political correctness. And those on the left seeing it also as a way to suppress them in certain ways, to challenge what they consider moral behavior. So again, the same concept is being misused, and what it fundamentally means has been forgotten. And so what I was hoping was that by the end, I had made some impression that if we started to think about civility, about us being citizens in our communities and in our countries, and beyond our own interests, that we could reclaim that word and use that word across the political spectrum to try to find those points of common intersectionality that are so sorely lacking these days.
Where do you think civility should be taught along the way? Should it be taught in the schools? Should it be taught in the homes and the newspapers? Where do you think that should be located?
Well, you probably remember there was a question that came in from what were called one of the portal people, and those were the groups that were that were in shipping containers around the world, which sounds strange to me too, but I'm sure they were air conditioned.
From Mexico City and Kigali and
Rwanda.
Yeah. It didn't quite work.
It didn't quite work, but I thought it had actually a real charm, and it reminded me of the dial-up days of AOL. I can't imitate that noise, but it was kind of like that, because slowly they would fade from black to full color. But there was a question about teenagers and social media and what to do about the many problems there. I was a little bit flip in my answer, but I really did mean what I said, which was look to the parents. Look to the parents as role models for behavior, all sorts of behavior. And in that smaller context, it was, well, how do they use their devices? When are they on? When are they off? And what kind of behavior are they modeling? But I think in a much larger sense, things start with families. That's before you get to school. That's before anybody's reading a website or a newspaper. Those values, those behaviors have the greatest impact on anyone. So basically what I'm saying is we need to look into ourselves. We need to understand and analyze our actions, our language, our interactions, and then try to understand the impact they will have on others.
When we have a president who campaigned with nicknames, Crooked Hillary and Low Energy and Lion and Little and Pocahontas, all these, by no means were those the worst terms used in American history in campaigns, but they were a lot of what went on. And then he had his cries of lock her up or get him out of here, out of my rally, or we all saw it. What do you think the civil response is when kind of the father figure, the president or the people campaigning for president are doing it in a non-civil way?
Nathaniel, that's a really good question. I'm going to come at that a little bit sideways. So for the last 2 years since Donald Trump has become president, this type of question comes up all the time. What's to be done about him? He is the president. He is a role model. I guess I just need to start off by saying I cannot myself solve the problem of Donald Trump.
well, damn.
Yeah, I know. But I also don't know that the real problem is Donald Trump. initially after the 2016 election, I did. And I thought that his behavior, his actions, his name calling during the campaign, they were horrific. They did take us down into the gutter. Marco Rubio got right down there with him, as did others. It was appalling. Then I really came to the conclusion post that November, even though the majority of Americans did not vote for him, a very, very sizable number of millions did. That's where the real problem is. And that is to say, that problem is amongst us. He's a symptom of that, and he's now fanning those fires. In a way, what I'm going to say is a little bit of a Republican point of view, which is to talk about personal responsibility. We can choose how we act towards people. We can choose the language we use. We do not need to just sort of, because he is acting in such egregious ways, accept that that legitimizes it. So we have a lot of personal agency in here. And so one of my more recent messages is trying to make people more aware of the fact that they do, and that this is not who we are as a country. And he is on the fringe, but he is tapping into this really deep vessel of fear and of hate.
Part of that campaign was a democratic notion of if they go low, we go high, which I found very appealing. But there's also something I think appealing about those people on the progressive side who are willing to fight back in kind. And I think there's a tussle right now between those different sides of sort of the progressive brain, between our desire to be civil, our desire that's rooted in, I don't know, Gandhi and King and Thoreau to be civil, and the love side of the equation, versus when something is really bad and it could go down the road, you know, some people fear to fascism or something, that you can't be gentle in those times.
I'm very aware of sort of that debate, and that there have been a number of prominent Democrats who have now abandoned Michelle Obama's mantra of when they go low, we go high, including Eric Holder, including Hillary Clinton, and several others. In a very practical way, I think that is effective as a strategy. I think it appeals to the Democratic base. As we've seen on the right, it's kind of a red meat type of approach. Get them activated and growling, and hopefully, you know, to the polls. I believe in certain principles, and I don't know that we can just trade them off for political expediency. Again, sort of digressing for a moment, I see here in North Carolina the enormous amount of gerrymandering that has gone on by the Republicans. Hopefully the Supreme Court will take care of that. But what has made it very difficult in the state is that the Democrats had done the exact same thing a generation or two ago. And so it's the party in power creates the rules and then exploits the rules for their own behalf. And we just kind of then go in this really insidious circle. So that's what I fear will happen if everyone kind of gets into the sandbox and gets messy. And that's how I am seeing what's happening with Donald Trump and Nancy Pelosi right now. They're both in a sandbox. They're both very strong characters. And where are we getting? I don't think we're getting anywhere there. We want to get to a better place, and we want to be our better selves and our better country again. And those folks on the left, I want to talk about them for a minute. Like, there have been a number of protests in restaurants where Trump officials have been, and specifically around the border wall. And there have been chants, and I think they've driven Rubio out, they drove Cruz out, a number of politicians. They've been castigated for being inappropriate. I think that kind of civil disobedience is 100% appropriate. If it turns to violence, then you have crossed the line, in my view, and in the view of just about everyone else, including law enforcement. But civil disobedience takes us very far, and civil disobedience is legitimate behavior. It's a legitimate part of the American experience. I don't want that to sort of become this like other set of behavior. That is mainstream behavior that, and to use the language of manners, that is correct and American.
I was almost surprised to hear you support that, but I guess I understand. There was the direct action of confronting senators at elevators during the recent Supreme Court debate. What was your take on that? It doesn't sound like it steps over your line of civility at all.
Absolutely not. He's a political official. He was in a public place. They were citizens. They were, I believe, in, you know, involved with various organizations, which is great and fine. And they found an opportunity. They found an opportunity that was streamed or broadcast in some way, so it was very public. They made their case. They never threatened him. There was no aspect of that. I mean, it was a very engaged American experience that certainly in the moment and the day after seemed to have a tremendous amount of effect when he called for the week's delay. And had they been arrested because they were on private property, yep, that's the penalty for trespassing. And usually people know that and understand that there's a cost to be paid for civil disobedience and for standing up for your principles. Again, not crossing certain lines where you're harming people, where you're threatening people, which I also talked about in the TED Talk, because then you're kind of in a really dark netherworld, and that's a scary place, and that is not in an American place, even though there is plenty of that in the American experience too.
My own take has been we need in our coalition both the people who are civil and the people who are willing to push hard at the limits of that, and hopefully not the people who are crossing the boundary, but sometimes those are the ones that get attention.
It's interesting you say that, Nathaniel, because when I was a younger gay,
there were the ACT UPs of the world, the groups that were pushing those limits back then, right?
Yeah. So there were the ACT UPs of the world, and then there were also, sort of on a cultural level, there were the drag queens, and there were the guys in leather, and some who were considered fringe by centrist gays. This goes back to, you know, both appearance. I always appeared as a Brooks Brothers homosexual, which is how I had characterized myself at one point. But what was coming out of my mouth was acceptance of all of these groups, and especially as a political means to strike and to push boundaries. Had ACT UP not been in the streets protesting and getting arrested and getting those headlines, we never would have seen the advances in the AIDS pipeline, and we never would have seen similar advances in breast cancer pipelines and tons of other diseases. So it takes a village, and it takes a village that some of whom are willing to sort of flank far left, but that's part of an overall strategy, or should be. So I never think those in the center should like disavow them, unless they're disavowing them just for like superficial reasons and because they have to, but I think we're all in this together.
There's a tendency to call the other side misogynists and racists and other names that seem to fit. It doesn't seem always too helpful. What's your take on the use of terminology like that by us?
Yeah, I talked about that and feels like I'm name-dropping the TED Talk, but since it just happened last week and that's how we met, I hope you'll let me do
it's
that.
It's a common name, Ted, anyway.
All my friends now call me Ted Nathaniel, so you can call me Ted, too. They're done with
happy
me.
To.
What I said was that I have stopped using misogynist, xenophobe, homophobe, racist, sexist in my columns because I actually found them to be, first of all, I found them to be ineffective. They're just kind of these buzzwords that a lot of people glance over, or they're incendiary to those on the right and just provoke rather than help to start conversations or find common ground or find a common heart. And there was a part of that talk that got left on the floor. And I gave an example of how I did not use homophobe, but what I did instead. And so I did a column in USA Today in the fall on the 40th anniversary of Harvey Milk's assassination by Dan White, the white police officer, who was anti-gay on the record. You know, there were votes that had happened, but I didn't call him a homophobe. I described his vote on the equality bill that was in San Francisco. And then I went very clearly through what happened in City Hall that day, how he took Harvey Milk into Harvey's own office, shot him 5 times, twice in the head, this was all from police records, and really left it to the reader in that column to decide what they think of someone who does that. I don't think homophobe even comes anywhere near the gravity of the awfulness of those actions, frankly. I think they're not useful terms for many reasons.
It seems like they're often used when you are inferring that kind of attitude because you can't always know someone's heart. but you feel like you see enough evidence to call them that, to call them out on that. And that's part of the culture a bit now.
It is part of it. And it's problematic because unless you have a lot better vision than I do, I think it's really hard to see into somebody's heart. And those are people we know. And, you know, so when we're talking about people we hardly
enough to
know.
See into our own hearts, I think.
Well, that, you know, that too. But then we think about political foes and so on. It's really challenging. And one of the points I often make is that, you know, John McCain was respected by those Republicans who supported him, but by many, many of his opponents across the board. And that was because he knew that he could not look into someone's heart and see. He chose not to make personal characterizations and to make personal attacks. I think he was at one point a contemporary with Jesse Helms, and he spoke to Helms on the votes that Helms made, but did not speak to any personal issues. And if I remember correctly, John McCain came to learn that Helms had adopted a child with some sort of mental health problems. It was like a whole other story to Helms that really had nothing to do with his votes and may have made him in a certain way, quote unquote, a better person, but that doesn't matter either. You have to judge somebody on their votes. But anyway, the point was, don't make it personal, and we really can't know what is in people's hearts. And we're a democracy that it's based on laws and votes and that sort of thing. That's where we should focus our attention, if not ire.
There's an interesting story I read recently about Beto, who ran for Senate in Texas. He had taken a road trip with a Republican congressman, Hurd, a border congressman, and they had gotten along, and then they had the non-aggression pact, I think, in their campaigns. That's sort of rare right now to form any kind of bond across partisan lines. And that now is getting used against Beto by people to his left because he's not pure enough. And this is the way we run politics a lot on the left is, can we call you names if you're not pure enough?
Yeah, I read that story, I think it was over the weekend, and his response was he was putting country over party. Am I remembering correctly?
Something like that, yes. I think we read the same thing.
Yeah. It's actually the first time that I had sort of read about that whole scenario. And at first take, I thought, oh, wow, that's great. That's how he sees it. And that's what he's doing. But the other interpretation was that O'Rourke is just going to always be for O'Rourke. And he's kind of a loner. And it's all about him. And I think that's kind of where the left started to pile up on him.
It's going to be interesting to see, because maybe one of his virtues, I don't know who I'm for personally, but one of his virtues seems to be that he is willing to sort of do things differently, like he did his campaign differently, that attracted people. But it may also be, it may kill him to not have gone down tried and true roads and used tested strategies and avoided problems that a more conventional politician might.
It's certainly conventional wisdom to build allies and alliances within your own party and then from there. Although, as we saw with Donald Trump, he did not do that, and that did not hinder him. In the end, he just ran over everyone. Were O'Rourke able to do that, I still don't think that is actually a good path, but it seems more possible these days. I think you get to another point that matters, and I'm talking about intersectionality, but I'm talking about it sort of in the largest sense. So not just racial and ethnic groups and women's groups and LGBTQ groups and so on coming together, understanding the need for alliances and strategy, but really just sort of in the broadest sense that those left of center, which is not only the left, need to find and understand those commonalities and not make everything a litmus test. Because I'd be far from the first person to say, you know, the left is so wonderful at eating its own and destroying its own. What do we do about that?
I think we look for leaders who are able to span across the spectrum. And honestly, in the long run, we want someone who can speak not just to the people on one party or allies of the party, but across the whole country. We kind of need an antidote to what the last years of partisanship have done to us. What would you like to see in a Democrat governing after 2020 if that were able to happen? terms of style and civility and so on?
I'm not ready to name names, but I think that most of the Democrats, but not all of the Democrats who are sort of considered likely candidates or who have already said they're candidates, play within a narrower range, a better range of what's considered civil behavior and civil discourse. And whether Donald Trump exits in 2020 or God forbid in 2024, there will be a flip, a reversion back, because that is often the case regardless of what goes on. And you can certainly see Trump being that to President Obama. But Americans, every time you poll them, they're really sick and tired of this general incivility, this lack of progress, and sort of feeling that the core of our DNA is being eroded daily. Are you ready to name names yourself?
No. I'm heartened by the breadth of candidates and skills that I see. There are certainly, I have some internal ordering of who I like, and I'm sure that's going to change as the horse race changes. And I'm not sure that we won't have a re-election either. I'm not sure what's going to happen. It's hard to imagine a president who doesn't bring us back to norms of either party.
Yeah, it is hard to imagine that. You know, I saw something interesting on Facebook, I think it was last week, and it was after Senator Gillibrand announced for president. And it must have been an ad, and she was asking people to join her cause. I probably looked through about 300 or 400 of the responses, and I would say 95% of them, and I'm not going to say it was representative, but 95% of a very large number all condemned her for her actions vis-a-vis Al Franken and held her responsible for pushing him out, and the majority by far considered that that had been wrong. That was just kind of fascinating in many ways. One, it was her own ad, so she had not expected this. And two, I too thought that his behavior, when you looked at it on sort of the Weinstein scale of horrific, and there's really a spectrum of behaviors, in my view, you know, he was not at the far end.
His misbehavior was much more minor. It's demonstrably less egregious than on the Weinstein scale, regardless of whether it's coming from us, I think.
Yeah. And so Gillibrand really denied him due process. I mean, he did resign, but she really, you know, pushed that in a way that, you know, and so she's going to be held accountable for that, it appears. And I think she should.
You would think there'd be a lot of overlap between people who support Franken and people who are very strong supporters of Me Too. I don't know whether it divided that group. And I also don't know whether those comments that you're reading are being generated organically by people, which is quite likely. There's, I'm sure, a lot of people that hold that sentiment, or whether they're being ginned up by a campaign or by an external organization who means mischief to her. I have no idea.
That is a very good point. We don't know these days. And it was on Facebook.
Just from talking to friends, I know that that sentiment is around, and I think I hold it to some degree. Certainly, I lament the loss of Franken, and I wish he hadn't gotten himself into trouble.
And I think I might put it the other way, that I regret what he did, and second that.
You have to be very careful in how you talk about these things. I'm rarely careful enough.
When Gillibrand did it, I thought, you know, she was ginning up her own candidacy with that and trying to put a stake in the ground. That's what it seemed like to me.
She often feels like she moves to capitalize on a moment. She has moved herself politically from one place to another, and it's so hard to disentangle what the motivations are when someone moves. Are they growing? Are they positioning, et cetera? And everyone's going to face those kinds of questions.
Over the weekend, I had dinner with a group of friends, all progressive and in various ways. And so we were having discussion, who were we supporting? And there were a variety of candidates. And then one friend of mine kept nailing each one of us down, but you will support the Democratic nominee no matter who it is at the end, won't you? Won't you? And he was insistent on that.
Yes, I think there's a lot of people that feel that way.
Yes, and he badgered every single one of us into like a public vow about that.
Yes, But you can't force other people to do it, and people will make their own mistakes.
If only we could learn from our previous mistakes, though. And that certainly was one of them.
Well, we lost Al Gore that way, too. So it's been great to talk to you, Stephen. Is there a question I should have asked that you would have liked to answer, but I didn't?
My niece is in a journalism class here at Duke now. And she's doing a profile on me. So she interviewed me the other day and she had all her good questions. And then I said, well, she was done. And I said, well, you should always ask at the end, is there anything else that I didn't say? Because you just never know what they're going to say at the end. But I think you tied it up nicely, Nathaniel. I don't think there was anything else today.
Well, I very much appreciate your time and enjoyed the conversation.
Likewise, very much.
That was Stephen Petro. He's at www.stephenpetro.com. You might want to check out Stephen's Civilist podcast. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at resistancedashboard.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.